Wilson and I are here at Window Rock, Arizona, capital of the Navajo Nation. It's July the 8th, 1971. We are here to attend a reunion of the Navajo Code Talkers to be held during the next 2 days. We hope to tape things that are of major interest and schedule events and to record interviews with individuals about their war experiences.
I lived in Hollywood for I don't know how many years after I went down studying at Oldham. And I remember my wife, she's an Anglo, and she ties her hair like a Navajo, you know, back here. It's a knot. Like that. Down the picture. Nobody noticed nothing, you know. They don't even give it a second look. When we were living in Hollywood, had a nice home there. And but when we came out here, when we go come out here, see everybody looks at her and giggles, you know, and especially the non-Indians, they poke at each other and, you know, point at her. And I guess I don't know what they say, but Navajo women, they come up and say "Njone," which means beautiful. They tap her hair and they say "Njun."
During World War II, in some of your battles, can you think of some anecdotes, hairy experiences that you had?
Were you on ship or were you on shore or who was your teammate and did you have the same teammate most of the time?
No,
they exchanged.
See, some of the Navajos were in the front line working with the communicators, this is the way it worked. Marine Corps communication, they use Morse code, they use what they call PPX, I think it was, just like we're talking. And then they use their own code.
Low speed radio transmission.
Yeah, it's a code that they use in all these years. It's on the cylinder. Mm-hmm. And then the Navajo code. And let me see, there was another one there. But anyway, all these simultaneously work together. You know, I mean, they're all going at the same time.
Were there, you mean different, the same message in these different forms or different messages?
Different forms and different messages. Yes, sometimes it'll be the same message.
Which level did you serve on?
I was kind of in the back, in the rear, headquarters.
You were in headquarters?
Well, I was with the company, rather, company. See, each company.
You were in a company command post?
Yes. Each company had a Navajo. Company A, Company B, Company C, and they all the headquarters. They'll have to. They sent their message back into the headquarters.
And then you message back.
Yes, and then I translate that back. Well, there was more than one that was in the headquarters. Bill Yazzie.
That's Dean Wilson.
Wilson, yes.
Yes, Judge Dean Wilson.
Well, he really got good. He was really good with the. Cool. So he went. They advanced him into the original headquarters, into the main, where the main.
But you were on a company level.
Yeah, I was on.
What were some of the on Saipan, for instance, when those pictures were taken? Was that after the battle was over? Or?
Well, that was when they were shelling us.
The picture was taken while they were shelling.
Yeah, because, and they didn't know where the shelling was from until we found out there was a tower on one of the hills there, and they had a tunnel underneath it. They had, I don't know how many Japanese were underneath there, and they run up there and they guide artillery from there, you know. And they were placed in different positions, these artilleries, but these were as a tower. It was served as an observation post. Well, that's when I was looking through the binocular, watching the movements there.
You look pretty serene in that picture, as if nothing was going on at all. This is my understanding, that the Navajos were more serene under fire than the pale faces. Do you think that's true? You don't think so?
I say that the Navajo Marines
were the first to hit the deck.
Were the first one to hit the deck whenever the shooting started.
But you can measure a split second.
Yeah.
Well,
they disappear. I mean, you might be talking to me and shell whiz by and I'll be gone.
But that's not what I hear all from everybody. I think he's being modest.
That's one of the first things not only Navajo Marines learn is hit the deck.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have much real experience where that I was in the combat. But one of the boys, he was with the company. He really went through a lot of torture. They banzai.
Yes.
In his company, they banzai, I think, four times. And he really had a rough time.
Who was it? You remember
his
name?
He died in Chicago just a few years ago. John Willie. John Willie was his name.
John Willie?
Willie, yeah. He was from Loop.
He was not a code talker.
He was a code talker. But yeah, he was a company. He was in the front line.
I see.
What did he die from?
I don't know. I really, he had a problem when he got out. It's like Pima Indian.
Ira Hayes.
Yeah, he started drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what really, helped.
You know,
speed his.
Yeah, you were talking about this banzai. That's when the Japanese come. Suicide.
Yeah,
the suicide.
They
yeah.
They just run and holler and attack. They use sticks, anything.
Yes.
Some of them were using guns.
Rosalind Curtis,
right.
Telephone at the desk,
others,
please.
They just
Rosalind
use a stick
Curtis.
And they just, some of them are just running around. It's like crazy.
They were going to be killed anyway, so they were just the last.
I imagine
last
so.
Pitch.
What did you think about the Navajo Marines code talkers?
I think they help. It's a combination of working together, teamwork.
I remember that's what you wrote to me in a letter this year.
You can't say that. If it wasn't for the Marines, like they always say, like for Texas, if it wasn't for Texas helping us, we would have never won the war.
Mm-hmm.
The Marines help.
I think they shortened, from what I hear, they must have shortened the campaign in the South Pacific. Wouldn't you say so?
Well, I think the 1st and 2nd Marines, when we went in, boy, we were just hitting like that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Navajo code talker were kind of pushed aside. Like, we were still using it, but it wasn't, they didn't. You start using the Navajo code until about the 4th Marine Division. I heard that they use that a lot. So
that's, I understood that too. Now, when did you think the use of the code was the most effective? I mean,
I would say that they were effective spotting artillery or they want to shell, throw artillery or shell into a certain area. You know, all that is set
and narrow. Pinpointing the targets.
FOs for observers?
Yeah. They have maps there that were divided into squares, quad squares, I think they used to call them. And they had numbers, say 265 artillery needed, or if it's behind a mountain like that, they use a house. Well, that's when the Navajo language came in. Real effectively, because it was done so fast. I remember one place there where we got the Navajo code down so pat that this Navajo said they're gonna have a score dance in 4:11. Stand by. Birds are coming, or you know, like I forgot what he said exactly, but it sounded like they were having a lot of fun score dance.
And
but actually, what he meant was that they won't they won't rain artillery there, and they won't bomb us with the birds. You know, birds is an airplane, fighter plane.
Hummingbird was a fighter plane, I believe. Wasn't that it?
I forgot.
Oh, I had been riding with it and working with it so much that some of these things are kind of clear.
Well, I noticed they have it in the let me see. Summer school.
Nice.
Looks like that little write up about me.
Very
there.
Good. Very good.
Yeah. Okay, now. City, they were just birds, plane, bombers, bombs. No, just this bomb.
Bomb was the Navajo. Yeah, egg.
Yeah.
The Navajo word for egg. Mr. Gorman, would you say in Navajo?
I know dive bomber is a chicken hawk.
A chicken hawk.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
Would you say? Going to have a squaw dance over the hill, and what else did you say?
Well,
the birds are coming. You're coming. Would you say that in Navajo, or can you remember?
I could remember.
Well,
here, it's not too long, but here was what I was trying to put across. See, here is the cove. Different place, mostly animals. So
I know I have the whole code.
Yeah, but the first word, looks like, see, ant. Okay, that represents a ant. But see, in Navajo, Willachi, it's got no a.
Mm-hmm.
Willachi is ant in Navajo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now it got so that when the Navajo having a score dance in quad 12, bring your birds, you know.
Yes.
Birds coming in first, and you know, they'd be talking like that.
What was squaw dance? What did that mean?
Squaw dance is just a little celebration, ceremonial celebration. That's actually it's a what they call in Navajo.
But in other words, things were going to get pretty hard.
War
dance.
Yes. But I'd like to hear you say it in Navajo. I mean, as if you were a coach talking.
No question. I'm going there. Nta na 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 kit ata na sabuike. Ane tsidi da te hushten sang. That's all.
Thank you.
No wonder the Japanese couldn't break the code.
No.
Well, you got so you when you told these little stories that the guy on the other side would, when he came across a Navajo, he would write it printed and neatly printed it.
Yes, he understood what it meant. That the in this one is the most. most important thing was the number of the place that's going to be. That was the most important.
But what was Quad 12?
Quad 12 is just, they were
stayed
all.
On the map.
I know, but what was that in Navajo? What were the words that you said?
Naso means that quad.
Mm-hmm. 12 is what?
Natizata.
Yeah, I was a radio operator in the Marine Corps in the Korean War.
Korean War. That was Truman's War.
Yeah.
Well, I had a brother in there that walked clear back from the
Chosin?
Yeah, from that
reservoir.
Those reservoirs. Yeah. He carried a Marine on his back most of the way. Frozen.
Yeah. Got a lot of frozen feet and toes and fingers.
He's in that book. Clarence Gorman is his name.
Clarence Gorman?
Yeah, he was in there. He was in the Marine Corps.
Have you kept track of any of the code talkers since you got out
no,
of
the service? No, I most of my time I spent off the reservation. In order to survive, to get good jobs, you know. You can't get any work.
Mr. Gorman, when I was here a year ago, you had been teaching at a school out here.
Well,
and you had just left. I think you left the day before I came or something. It was in March.
Well, they gave me such a beautiful picture of the place, what they were going to do, you know, Teller College.
Yes.
And I was supposed to teach art and the cultural part. And something happened, and they couldn't pay me the money. It was just the amount of money that I thought I'd get. I'm getting double that amount in the University of California. So it would have been good if they went through.
But they didn't build that.
Well,
they
had their own internal problems, I think, trouble that ruined the whole thing.
They had. I think they were in trailers or barracks or
yes,
something.
They're still up there.
How many of the code talkers were killed during the war?
Well, with the 29 that I joined, one of them got killed right on in the action.
Who was what? Which
his
one?
His name
it?
Was Sosi. Sosi.
Yes.
Well,
I have that. It's on that.
Well, anyway,
it's in that picture that you have.
Anyway, but this is what happened. When we were pulling out, the first time we were pulling out Guadalcanal, he had an appendix. He was attacked, you know, appendicitis. So they pulled him out. They operated on him, and then they sent him back. After he got well, they sent him back with the other troop that went in. And that's the same troop that hit the Palu, I think was
Hello.
The name, yeah. And that's where it was pretty rough there. That
he went back into the 1st Marine Division.
Yes, it must be, yeah, a replacement there.
Yeah,
did he go still as a code talker?
No, he was.
He just went in as a fighter.
Well, second thought, I don't know. I really don't know. But he got hit.
Well, I've read someplace, and I think it is in the book, that a surprisingly small number of code talkers were lost. There were 420 all told, and there was only a comparatively, there was a small number. I don't know what.
Nobody has that number.
I don't think I know. Quite a few of them were killed in after they got out of the service. Like this one of the Oscar Eichmann. He got hit on Saipan. His spinal. In the back, you know, with shrapnel. They used to shoot shrapnel, right? And they'll explode right over in the air. And we were stunned, and we were laying there. After all night, we were fighting all night. And we sleep in daytime. As soon as the sun goes down, it gets dark, and then the action starts. Well, anyway, early in the morning, bang, this thing shot right over us. Shrapnel hit hit his back. I wasn't in that cave sleeping in there. I probably would have been hit too. But it bothered him. It bothered him, you know, until it got so unbearable. He said that he'd kill himself. Well, I don't know.
Was that after he came back here?
Yeah, after he came back, he tried to go to a veteran hospital and explain.
Jimmy Sosi, telephone to the desk,
it's
please.
Too close to your spine. But he was in California working there, and he got so bad that he came back, got back to Gallup, and got in front of a super chief in a train called Super Chief. And he just took his coat off and folded, and when he saw the train coming, he walked in front of it, and the train just ran over.
Yeah. Now, I understand that from Dean Wilson, I had about an hour and a half with him when I was here before, that on the reservation, they do have these squaw dances for the returning men.
Yeah.
And
I tell you,
most interesting psychologically.
Well, it's a thing that you know, when you're in a combat, you start thinking about, especially if you kill people. You start getting nightmares. It works on your mind, and that's where this enemy wake ceremony. It's called enemy wake ceremony. It's not quite what they call it, squad dance.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a ceremony called enemy wake. Okay, now. It's a more of a ceremony that will do your mind, correct your mind, come back and get back in harmony with nature. That's what it is, your mind. See, like well, here's a good example. Like this Cali, this army guy that went berserk and started killing children and old women. Probably now he has dreams, and you know, his mind is all probably it's working on his mind. Now, if he had a squat dance, he'd be.
What would you call it? Enemy what?
Enemy
way. W-A-Y. It means ceremony or right. Mm-hmm. It's in enemy way. Now,
did they do this overseas? Did you have
no,
this
no.
Is when you come home.
After
when
you come, yeah.
It is.
It's a ceremony that takes for 3 days, actually, the activities. 3 days of it.
But when the Navajo Code Talkers came home, did they have these ceremonies?
It's
for
pretty expensive, probably, some of them.
They do them, it's just one at a time, isn't it? It's for one person.
Yeah, one.
Just for one, it isn't for a whole ceremony.
This is the
game.
Traditional Navajo.
It's a Navajo religion, Navajo way of getting your mind back in harmony with nature.
Mm-hmm.
In other words,
purification.
Purification is it goes along with it. I know there was a girl. She doctor gave her up, and she was a.
This was called Navajo singing.
Navajo way. Yeah, see that there's different way, blessing way. Blessing way, the 9 day chant way, night chant way, enemy way. Oh, there's several ceremonies, powerful ceremonies, dealing with
healing.
Dealing with healing. This enemy way is with your dealing with your mind.
And the medicine man is a predominant figure in it. And
well, not only the medicine man. There is a what they call Dyke's notician, herb man, medicine man, and the priest, Navajo priest. See? They analyze your case.
Problem.
Yeah, the Dyke's notician will tell you what's wrong with you, and the herb man will prescribe certain herbs for your body, and of course the medicine man. Does the ceremonial chant.
I'm saying the enemy way. Do all of these people help the medicine man in said that that relatives are they're in an area, and usually aren't some of the relatives with the medicine man.
Yeah, yeah.
The medicine man has often has a bundle. I guess he does have a bundle of some sort, and if a man has come back from Japan, for instance, and
that's one way. See, they one way, and then sometimes they'll get a skull or a part of enemy's bone, and they'll shoot right close to you 4 times, you know, and that would cut off all their communication as in between the mind and the enemy that's causing the sickness.
Dean Wilson said that it was also that the enemy way ceremony was a way of uniting the family. You knew, or not uniting the family, but it gave you a feeling that you were united with the family. It was a psychological
this kind of affair is a big thing, and the family and the relatives, they all have to take part. Mm-hmm. It's not one person can't, unless he's got a lot of money. Mm-hmm. The family's got to help, join, and that's where all this unity.
They all contribute. And
that's
so,
right,
yes.
That's right.
It's
not a community. It's like, that's where the real true community comes in.
Well, did he tell you anything that I would want to know before I came in?
No, I was just getting his background, where he went after he got out of the service.
I see. You're more interested in that than
I'm interested
in I can't recall anything that was so.
Well, what about the night that your friend, got hit by the shrapnel, you were in the cave?
Well, that was in the morning, early in the morning.
What was his name again?
Oscar Ilma.
How do you spell it?
Oscar.
And his last name, how is
Ilma.
It?
Ilma. I-L-T-L-A-N. Ilma. Something like that. He was hit. Let me see. Well, and there were another time when they were shelling Saipan before we got off the ship. We all moved in, and then we were ready to get out, and all of a sudden a shell hit the ship that we were on, and we were just about to get to the top when that shell hit, and we all just fell back down below.
Yes, that's understood.
there was a whole pile of Marines just piled on each other, and you know, we just fell down. But that was real close.
What do you remember about the war? I mean, this experience for you, what do you think it did for you?
Well, I think the Marine Corps did me quite a bit. It made a man out of me. I was working for the government, VIA, you know, mm-hmm. when the war started. Of course.
You were over?
Right here. Mm-hmm. Of course, right away, they start cutting down the employees. The Indians were the first one to get, and then I was the first one to get hit, and I was one of them, so I got laid off. So I turned right around and joined the Marine Corps.
And you weren't.
I joined it more for not to be patriotic, but more for because I was hungry.
How old were you, Carl?
I was. Well, that's another thing. I was around 30. 28, I think it was.
Well. Original
29. Yes.
Many of them were much younger than that, weren't they?
Well, there were some, like Oscar Isma, I think he was the oldest one in the crowd. He was 35. And they were quite.
Very.
Well, there were some that lied about their age, weren't there?
Yes.
Dean Wilson was only 16, he said.
I don't know, but I was one of the ones. I was one of them that lied about my age.
Back.
Yeah.
Instead of setting it forward like some of them
yeah,
did.
Well,
yeah.
I set mine back.
You said, what did you tell them you were?
I there was a deadline on 30, I think it was. Mm-hmm. I said, 28 or something like
that. Yeah. And I hear
for instance. Well, that was over 30 or 31 or something like that.
How old are you now?
I'm 60.
So that would make it, 42?
42.
So that would be 2 from 10 is 8. No. If you're 60 now.
You were 31.
And you said you were 28.
That's good. Yeah, that's all right.
A lot of them lied about their age in both ways.
Yes, that's an interesting point because some were 15. Who was it? Was 15?
Well, Peter McDonald.
Peter McDonald was 15. And
well, let's be honest about a lot of these neighborhoods were hungry.
Sure, that's right. But they had to have those who had education were able to speak both languages fluently. And, after all, the age, I don't think, would make quite so much difference.
Today, even today, a lot of these Marines joined the service because they're so, they're John Wayne, they're not John Wayne.
What was the patriotic feeling when the recruiters came around?
Well, they like at that time, I don't know, but at that time, the first time when they went 39, well, see, I got laid off from my work, so I didn't have anything to deal with. We talked to another boy, John Bernard, both of us. He was working at UBC. I think he got laid off too. So we talked about it. So let's join one of the toughest outfits over there. Maybe we'll never come back. No, that's the way we talk. And anyway, that's how we happen to join the Marine Corps.
Well, there are historical things to prove that not just the co-talkers, but a lot of the Navajos came out of the hills and offered their services. That might be because they were hungry.
Right,
that might have been part of it.
There was some that wanted
publicity. I wouldn't. Yeah. If I was to live on my publicity, I'd be this millionaire.
What about this Teddy Draper who wrote the letter?
Yes, so I think in that case.
See, I had a
You know this, you can.
Well,
had the hernia corrected and wrote a letter to the draft board saying.
Now I'm ready to kill jazz.
Yeah.
Well, when they trained the first 29 Marines, we were ready to be shipped out. We were ready to ship out. Some of those Navajos, they backed out. They say, "Oh, I can't talk with the English." They're trying to start making an excuse.
Of the 29?
Yeah. So some of them said, "Oh, well, this is it." So.
Well, I
mean, there wasn't a gung-ho feeling after boot camp.
They weren't. There were no John Wayne.
Well,
after the Marines, Navajo Marines, the first 29 got in and shipped out. They held two Navajos. So these two, they came back and they started recruiting Navajos. I don't know what they were telling Navajos.
And they.
But you say they were no John Waynes, but what?
Just ordinary run of the what I mean to say is that I don't want the public to get the idea that we're super race, that we're something that we're entirely different. We're just like the next citizen.
But you weren't citizens then.
Well, that's true.
but
we're just like the next guy, that's all.
But you were endowed by nature in some way ahead of the white man.
Well, they had a language.
Being hardy, well, not, I don't mean that. I mean, they were hardy. They were used to hardship living in the outdoors.
Well,
and that sort of thing. And so when they went into the combat area, they were really better prepared for some of those things than the white man was.
Well, I have seen some white men, especially. I thought the Navajos were rugged, really rugged. I have seen some rugged white guys, white young Navajos in the Marine Corps. Far more rugged, tough than the Indians.
Mr. Gorman had just left when I.
The above is an interview with Carl Gorman. And now I am talking to Mr. Ted Evans. Mr. Evans, I'd like to thank you for what you do now. Let me hold it then, because I'll be talking to you.
I am working as Director of Veterans Affairs here in Window Rock. The new program that was put up by the tribe for this past fiscal year with the new administration. I will be working directly today with the code talkers, the reunion people that are coming in. And I feel like that this would be a situation that would warrant a lot of personal contacts on my part so that I can be attuned to the needs and the benefits that would be derived from the questions and answers that would be going through. Now, I want to say this time that I was knocked out of the Code Talkers group back in 1942.
Did you start with them, Mr. Evans?
No, I did not. I was interviewed at this high school. In fact, some of the boys of my class, from my class, were in the Code Talkers group. I wanted to play football. So I stayed, and they gave me leave until after the football season. But during the last two games of the football season, I got hurt in my knee. And for that, they turned me down, and so I had to live with the civilian as a civilian until 1944 when I went to the service in the Army.
I went to the Marines. And how long were you in the service?
I was in the service 5 years, all told, from 1944 into 1953, so I had some some inactive reserve time.
I see. Well, we're going to be hearing you today and talking to you again. Thank you very much for the interview. I finally rounded up Teddy Draper, and now I'm going to have a little conversation with him about his experiences. Now, what? Just tell me anything that you would like to. I know that you wrote that famous letter that about the fact that you wanted to get right back and fight. And aren't you the one who wrote a letter saying that you had had a hernia operation and that now you were well and you wanted to get back into the lines? Weren't you the one who wrote that?
Yes, I did. I wrote that letter.
Here is Albert Smith, who was one of the co-talkers in here. Just a minute, but I'll let him just tell me anything he can tell me quickly. Which division were you with?
I was with the 4th Marine Division.
You were with the 4th Marine?
That's right.
Good.
And I was with the 23rd Regiment, 3rd Battalion. First started off as an infantry radio man. And then I worked my way up through the 14th Artillery. It's the 4th Marine Division, and then I also, on EWOL, I was with the flagship, with the naval, between the naval command and also the Marine fleet force.
Well, that, can you tell me any particular instance when you used the code, what it was of strategic importance, or well, any kind of an instance of the use of the code?
In what way?
Now, can you just think of a message that you sent that was of importance to the command? Did you work from ship to shore? Did you work from how?
At first, I worked from ship to shore, and I also worked from the ship to planes, and then later on EWOL, I was on shore working with the command with General Smith. And also, I was on the flagship with Nimitz. So this
were you on that ship where the Navajos gave the bum message, and just so that the admiral could hear what the Navajos sounded like?
Well, we did this in Pearl Harbor when we were in training,
mm-hmm.
And we did this quite frequently.
They get send fake messages.
That's right.
To confuse the enemy.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And now you always worked with a teammate. Did you work with the same one or did you change?
I was assigned to different units, so I changed.
I see. Your English is perfect.
I've been trying to get myself out of disadvantage.
Yes, I can see that. Now, can you just? I know we have to go in, Mr. Link said we have to go in, but what? Do you feel the importance and contribution of the Navajos to the winning of the war? Do you feel it was that you played an important part?
Yes, I do feel that way. But it was a lot easier. Where in the code messages through the Morse code, you had to decipher it, and it took an extra time. Where in Navajo, it came over in a Navajo language, and then the translation was a lot easier.
Well, I had the statement of 2 Japanese generals that they could not break your code.
Well, a lot of times we were interrupted in during the process of communication between our other men, and this was also an indication.
Yes.
And some at the beginning, it didn't seem to be too important, because most of us were in the infantry, like I was in the radio man in the infantry. But then as time went on, it became more important that on EWOL, I could not leave by myself. I always had to have a guard with me.
Because you were tremendous importance to the campaign.
And this was put out by the general.
Will you be around all the time?
I have a tight schedule
well, I just
this afternoon. I'm going to be leaving in a a few minutes to Crown Point, and then
one of
my in-laws getting married in Laguna, and so he wants an Indian wedding, and we have to travel quite a ways up towards Mount Taylor.
Well, I thought that if there were other questions that I could think of, I want you to.
Well, you could also get in touch. Or you could get in touch with me. See, I might be back tomorrow evening if I can make it.
Thank you so much.
Link was never a member of the Navajo Coast Caucus, but we felt with the 4th Marine Division that he was as much a Coast.